1939, I was finishing my term as governor of Kentucky, first time, and in September of that year, Senator Logan died. He was a junior United States Senator from Kentucky. My lieutenant governor was Keene Johnson of Richmond, and he'd already been nominated by the Democrats as my successor. And on the ninth day of October, 1939, I resigned from the governor's office, and Keene Johnson automatically became governor.
It becomes my duty, as my first official act, to appoint a citizen of Kentucky as United States Senator to represent our state in the Senate of the nation. I, as governor of Kentucky, in exercise of the authority vested in me by the Constitution of the state, do herewith appoint the Honorable A.B. Chandler, ex-governor of Kentucky,
I was in the House chamber at Frankfort. I know when it was. See, Governor Johnson was not a speaker. That's an affected speech. That's not a natural. He never could. And he was a weakling, I'm sorry to say. Proved it every way you know. I know the stout fellows here, and I know the ones that are weak.
Chandler gets a new title, Commissioner, and then reclaims an old one, Governor. More of a Kentucky legend in a moment.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're speaking to you now from the Nelson County Courtroom in Bardstown, Kentucky. The facilities of this station have been engaged for the next 45 minutes to bring you an address by the Honorable A.B. Chandler, Governor of the State of Kentucky, speaking on behalf of the re-election of President Roosevelt. Approximately 800 people are crowded into the rather limited space here in the courtroom, standing along the walls and filling the aisles. Added hundreds will hear the talk on the public address system as they stand in the courtroom square immediately in front of the building. Governor Chandler is to be introduced by Mr. Dan Talbot, Commissioner of Finance of the Commonwealth of Kentucky. The first voice you hear will be that of Mr. Dan Talbot. Mr. Talbot.
My friends of Nelson County and neighboring counties, it gives me quite a bit of pleasure to introduce or to present to you today the young governor of Kentucky who will speak in the interest of the re-election of our great president, Franklin Roosevelt. Governor Chandler, in the few months he's been governor, has brought to Kentucky the thing that she has sought so long. Decency in government. The record that he has produced in Kentucky speaks for itself. I will now present him, who will talk to you in the interest of the re-election of Franklin Roosevelt.
Talbot and my good friends from Nelson County, and you other friends of mine who have come from other sections of Kentucky today to be present upon this occasion, and to all of my fellow Kentuckians who listen in over the radio this afternoon. It's always a pleasure to come to Nelson County because in the past, your people have always been uniformly kind and courteous to me. I'm very much pleased to open the campaign in Nelson County and in this district of Kentucky after a return from numerous of the other states in the United States where I have campaigned for the re-election of the President of the United States. I want to say to you, my fellow Kentuckians, today that I entertain no considerable doubt about the result of this election. on the third day of November from the reports that I have gotten from the people that I have seen in the other sections of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, on the third day of November, will be a re-elected President of the United States. I'll keep for you in Kentucky, and Roosevelt will keep in the nation the governments of the people in the hands of the people where they rightfully belong. Thank you for that.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard the Honorable A.B. Chandler, Governor of the State of Kentucky, speaking in the interest of the re-election of President Roosevelt. Governor Chandler was introduced by Mr. Dan Talbot. This broadcast, which came to you from the Nelson County Courthouse in Bardstown, Kentucky, was commercially sponsored by the Democratic Campaign Committee and reached you through the facilities of WHAS. We now return you to our main studios in Louisville.
All through the war, I'd been in Washington on the Military Affairs Committee. By the way, the other night I spent a pleasant evening and the next day at lunch with Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. He and I are great friends, and we're the only two left of the Senate committee that was appointed from the Military Affairs Committee to visit the world battlefield during the Second World War. We took off from Washington in July of 1943 and landed in Long Beach, California over 3 months later, and we've been everywhere, all over the world. Lodge is my very good friend, but all the rest of them are dead.
The purpose of that was to inspect the non-military side of the war. From the Committee on Military Affairs, there was Chandler and me. We were not going to tell the generals how to command.
Then the war was over on both sides.
Yes, it's my intention now to leave as soon as possible for Kentucky and have a visit with Mrs. Chandler and the children. Of course, the boys were perfectly delighted when they learned that I was going to be baseball commissioner.
1945, I was offered in April of that year. And I'm the luckiest fellow in the world because my memory is good and accurate. I'd hate to have to concede that my memory was faulty, because indeed it isn't, you understand? So that's just pure luck at my age, I guess. But in April of 24th of 1945, I was unanimously elected to be the baseball commissioner by the club owners, 16 of them, meeting in Cleveland. And I had not sought it, and indeed I had not paid much attention to the fact that it was going on. But they called me in my office in Washington, and one by one they were on the telephone to tell me that they very much wanted me to undertake the job of being commissioner of baseball. I told them that I could not agree to leave my responsibilities in the United States Senate to the people of Kentucky and to the American people until the war was over on both sides. So they agreed to that, and so consequently I accepted the job but didn't leave the Senate until November of that year, first day of November. And then the war was over on both sides.
Of course, the boys were perfectly delighted when they learned that I was going to be baseball commissioner. Ben and Dan both said that they were certain that meant that they could go to baseball games free.
Well, how about that? What did you tell them?
I think that can be arranged.
Jackie Robinson's decision cost me that job. See, for 24 years, Judge Landis wouldn't let the black boys play. That's the record. And in January of 1947, when Ricky wanted to bring Jackie Robinson up, they, in the New York meeting of the owners, they voted 15-1 not to let Jackie Robinson play. 15-1. That was advice to me. So when I came home, Ricky came down here and came down here to my cabin and said, I can't do this unless you make a firm decision. And I said, bring him on in. So then it was 15-2. And that was a monumental decision, you know that. And I made that, and if I don't make that, he don't play. And I had Preston for it. Old judge wouldn't let him play for 24 years. That cost me that job.
I don't remember anything that was related, anything relating to Jackie Robinson that was related to Chandler not continuing.
Mr. Giles was the general manager of the Cincinnati Reds.
All that I know and all that I've heard, Mr. Branch Rickey was 100% responsible. for Robinson. Commissioner did not have to approve.
And tonight I want to acknowledge our gratitude to Almighty God and to our people. I want to ask all of them now that they've elected us not to leave us.
51 I passed up. I always thought and I still think that we could have beaten Weatherby if we'd run, but we would have complicated the situation of a great many of my friends who had made arrangements with him and who were satisfied that he was going to be reelected and they could keep their jobs. So I decided on not for me or for the people of Kentucky necessarily, but for them. So then in 1955, I ran for governor again. Won. Both times the primary and the general election.
And tonight I want to acknowledge our gratitude to Almighty God and to our people and to our determination. We'll not fail them. We'll not fail them. We can't afford to because they're great people and they deserve great things. And I want to ask all of them now that they've elected us not to leave us now because we want them to help us and we want to continue to have their good wishes and their goodwill and their prayer.
They've come too far now to leave you, Happy.
This is summer, the dark is our day, the corn tops ripe, and the meadows in the blue. While the birds make music all the day, the young folks...
Yeah, if I do say so, I could sing pretty good. I used to sing in the university choir at Transylvania. I used to be one of their soloists.
All merry, all happy and bright.
That's Mama. That's Mama.
And my Kentucky home, good night. Weep no more, my lady. Oh, weep no more.
Yeah, that's Mama.
We'll sing one song for my old Kentucky home.
There you are.
For my old Kentucky home, far away.
Yeah, I could sing pretty good, if I do say so. If I may modestly say so. I've been singing all my life, and I can sing that song. And that's sentimentally, for me, the most beautiful song there is.
Happy Chandler runs for national office. That story of 1956, coming up in a moment.
Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, I nominate as the Democratic candidate for the President of the United States, the incomparable A.B. Happy Chandler, Governor of the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
We thought that the Democrats were undertaking a futile thing. We thought we knew that they were going to nominate Stevenson in 1956. And we didn't think Stevenson would do very well, and indeed he didn't. Maybe nobody else would have, because he would have been, he would have had to run against Eisenhower, who was a national hero. And indeed, Stevenson did not run a good race. The Democrats did not have a good year, and Eisenhower was elected. But my name was presented to the Democratic National Convention as a nominee for the presidency. And Joe Leary put my name in nomination.
By any standard, the governor of Kentucky is equipped to carry the flag of the Democratic Party this fall. He is a seasoned campaigner who likes a good fight. His name is a byword in every home in America. Give the Democrats of the nation the tool, and they'll do the job in November. Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, I nominate as the Democratic candidate for the President of the United States, the incomparable A.B. Happy Chandler, Governor of the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
I say this to you, if that paper had been for me all the way, I might have been President of the United States. And I wouldn't have minded because we've had some awful common presidents. And I've served with some of them in the Senate. When it gets to the place where Lyndon Johnson can be president, or Harry Truman. And I was in the United States Senate 7 years with Harry Truman, and I'm not a Truman man. Now, he made some decisions that were in the public interest, but he left there, when he left there, the people thought about a little of him as anybody in my lifetime, you understand? And Roosevelt was no bright and shining light, and I knew him real good, too. So I wouldn't have been embarrassed to be president of the United States if you're going to compare me with people like that, you understand?
Waterfield ran to succeed me, and Clements and his associates ran Burt Combs. I have mixed feelings about Burt. I don't think he was particularly well qualified to be governor. I think he's a good lawyer, and I think he made a good judge, and I think maybe that was the place where he would have been better off if he had gone that way and stayed.
I want to be a little careful here because Happy and I are getting along good now. I don't want to say something which is going to reactivate him.
I have built more roads for the people of Kentucky than all the other governors from 1792 to the present hour. I mean aggregate and total. And all of them are free. Now, Burt Combs built toll roads. We haven't got any authority for building toll roads except what they pushed through the legislature, and it's unconstitutional. It's an illegal debt. My God, I'd hate to own those things. And the one he built to Prestonburg still will pay for itself. Some of them, I said this, and this is true.
Have any objection to building a toll road if you could pay for it with tolls? And if you could discharge your obligation within a reasonable time based on the tolls that people pay to ride on the road? This you cannot do. And he has not only, he didn't get a single bid on those bonds. When I was the governor, I got bids of 298 on road bonds to build interstate highways in Kentucky. 298, unprecedented. We reinvested the money in federal government bonds at 4.25 and made $2.5 million while we weren't using the money.
He claimed they would bankrupt the state, and he had this little saying, and he is and was a phrase maker, you know, and he used to say, toll roads are no good. They start nowhere and they go nowhere, and you get on one, you can't get off, and you get off of one, you can't get on. I think Kentucky, being a poor state, comparatively speaking, and with the great need that existed in the 50s and 60s, that toll roads were very important to the progress of Kentucky.
They were not necessary. I can't go with that assumption. That's not a good assumption. What do the toll roads do for us now? Even Nunn built one way across from Glasgow to Bowling Green. Well, I can shoot a cannon up and down that road 10 or 4 or 5 hours a day and never hit anybody. There's not anybody on the road. But here's an amazing thing that I've learned. If you promise a fellow a road, he'll vote for you. If you build it, he'll vote against you. I'll give you a sample. I built this road from Frankfort to Versailles before the interstate was built. And, of course, I started these roads in 1937. I built 10 miles of four-lane highway and paid for it from Versailles to Lexington in 37 and from Louisville to Middletown. Now, why did I do that? I hoped to connect these two cities. And I started at Louisville and came out to Middletown. I started at Lexington and came out here. Never was finished till I got back. So I finished it, and they said that I built it so I could get to the golf course. I mean, of all the silly things. How silly can you get, you know?
Chandler ends 40 years in politics. In a moment, Happy reflects on 50 years with Mama.
I spent $5,000 in 71 as an independent because I didn't want to have you, and got 40,000 votes. $5,000 and they spent $1 million over that. Over each one of them spent $1 million apiece. I wanted to find out then, though, whether they would vote against party or not. They wouldn't in Kentucky. They wanted to vote a party. I was ready and willing, and I felt able to undertake the difficult job of being their governor again. But now that they've made the decision, I humbly bow to their decision, and now it's mine. And those who want to write my political obituary are free to do so, because I do not intend ever to be a candidate for public office in this lifetime again. Now, some fellows cried when I said that, and they wrote me and told me, you know, and said, please don't, you know. But I said, no, the time will come. And when it does, and a fellow said, last night I heard you say that, said, you didn't really mean it, did you? You know? So I say, things like that happen in your life, you know, but I meant that. They're going to say that I was the outstanding political figure in this generation in Kentucky. They're going to say that. I'm not in doubt about that at all. Each fellow's going to have his own appraisal. I'm not a hypocrite, and I'm not a liar, and I tried to do for these people. My devotion to the causes that I espouse are genuine. You know, right now, I told people over at the university, I said, I don't have to prove that my love for the University of Kentucky is genuine, because I haven't missed an opportunity to serve it. I've been chairman of that trustees board, of course, for 8 years, and I've been on it 8 more years. And, of course, here's an amazing thing you'd be interested in, I guess. They've had 8 presidents of the university, and I've served on the board with 6 of them. The second one was kin to me, you understand? I bought the Coldstream farm and paid for it and gave it to him. I bought the Spindletop farm and paid for it and gave it to him. I built a medical center and put it over there and paid for it, you know. And you don't do that unless you're concerned. I fought the battle of salaries for those people. See, when I built a medical center, the president of the university is getting $10,000 a year. And I called him away from a board of trustees meeting, and I said, Frank Dickey, I've got to get Dean Willard, because he's been recommended to me by Dean Lippard of the Yale Medical School to build my medical center. And I'm going to get him if I can, but I got to give him $22,000 a year to come. That was 1956. And I said, I may be wrong, but I always thought that the head man ought to get the most money, the fellow that's running the thing. I said, you're the president, so I'm going to give you $22,500. He said, I can't take it. I said, I'll get somebody will.
Certainly one of the most significant roles that he played was that of establishing the medical center at the University of Kentucky, with the College of Medicine, the College of Dentistry, the College of Nursing, and the Teaching Hospital. His support also meant that the faculty salaries were increased, and the total appropriations for the university were significantly increased during his term.
Roses in December.
I won't tell you this. I thought people lost all the time. I mean, I didn't think you ever won anything till I got Mama. Mama came out here to teach school at Margaret Hall in 1924. I got to meet her there. And
I was already engaged to somebody else at that time. And I think that He showed his perspicacity and his determination. He wasn't about to give up on that. And so pretty soon, he had the whole floor.
We got married then in 1925. And I can't begin to tell you. No way to overestimate the value of her contribution to me and to our children and to our grandchildren and to everybody else. She's forthright. She's got a ton of character. My God, she's like the Rock of Gibraltar. I mean, you know, she's as solid as a rock, and fiercely loyal to her side and to her husband and to her children.
He's terrifically loyal. Anybody who's his friend is always his friend, and he never changes.
Now, I said once, when they told me on a certain occasion she was outspoken, I wanted to know by whom. And then I got in trouble, you know. And then I told somebody else once that that she had bugged me because she wanted me to take her someplace she hadn't been. And so I took her to the kitchen.
Well, he's kind of milked that pretty much.
And some fella asked me one day, said, how is she? And I said, well, I don't know. I said, I haven't spoken to her for 2 weeks. And he said, what's the matter? And I said, well, I hadn't wanted to interrupt her, you know.
Well, I think he does think that I have no difficulty with making my opinions known.
Financially, we're reasonably well off. We get through the winter, you know. But we would have been double well off if she hadn't had a proclivity for spending all she could get hold of, nearly. She's a great spender. I'm Scotch, of course, Scotch-Irish. And she thinks it was made to spend. She thinks it's a medium of exchange and ought to be exchanged freely.
You can't take it with you. And I feel that it's just a medium of exchange. I don't
you
see...
You exchange it freely, don't you,
Hank? Isn't that what it's intended for?
Well, I'm a savory, you know.
The way that it's deteriorating in value, I think we ought to spend it real fast. You know, life with anybody is not always a bed of roses. And we are just a normal couple. And where you have four children to fight about, you know, and all of that sort of thing, you just simply demonstrate your humanness, and he does too.
December, red roses of love.
Roses in December.
A Kentucky legend. The Chandler Years, the life of Happy Chandler told in sound. Historical recordings from the archives of WHAS Radio. Narration by Bill Britton. Executive supervision by Glenn Baston. Creative production by Jim Ferguson. A Kentucky legend, The Chandler Years, was written, edited, and produced by Jeffrey Marks.